By the way, if you would like to grace me with an email, I certainly have the time to read them all, and am indeed doing so. So there's two ways to get hold of me. Art Bell, that's ArtBell at mindspring.com, or ArtBell@AOL.com. The Mindspring address is probably the prime one. ArtBell@mindspring.com. Now, the good doctor has raised several times this rising above the place where you're being worked on and actually being able to observe and then later describe with actual brain death what was going on. Now, there's really no way to medically explain that. There's simply no way. Again, on the 60-minute show, doctor, they interviewed a doctor in an operating room, and they had lost many patients on the table. And so they actually went to the trouble of putting a large sign up on top of some piece of medical equipment so that if somebody did rise up in the room to the ceiling, they would be able to note the number and then later report it. And they used as negative as evidence that it not, really wasn't happening, the fact that nobody had yet come back and reported that number. Had you heard about that?
Yes, in fact, we actually did a study ourselves.
Oh?
In cardiac arrest patients, where we used various targets that were essentially had images that were only visible from the ceiling down and not from any other area, to try and test the claims of people who say that they're out of body.
And?
And the problem is that I don't know about the case you're referring to, but certainly from my own experience of having done this, one of the big difficulties is that near-death experiences happen in only about 10 to 20% of people who are resuscitated back to life.
Mm-hmm.
So if you imagine you start out with, say, 1,000 people who have a cardiac arrest, you're left with 200, or 100 to 200 who may have a near-death experience. Now, only a quarter of those, so maybe 25 to 50, would have an out-of-body experience. So in all the studies that this has been attempted, and certainly I know that people have perhaps tried it here in the U.S. as well, they've only looked in operating rooms where patients don't necessarily have a cardiac arrest, and it's very rare for it to happen there. When we looked in our study, we had 10% of people who had a near-death experience, but nobody claimed to have had an out-of-body experience. And the reason was that we followed everybody over a one-year period in our hospital who had a cardiac arrest. But 65 people in that 1 year survived. And so statistically, perhaps we should have had one person to have claimed, who would have claimed to have had an out-of-body experience. Mm-hmm. And that's why the only way to really test this phenomena is to do a large-scale multi-center trial where the study has the appropriate scientific power to detect whether this phenomenon really is taking place or not.
Well, then there's one other thing that I would have brought up in protest to that example that they gave, and that is that if you are on a table and you're dying, you're dead, and you float up above to the ceiling, probably the very last thing you'd be interested in would be some number or some design or anything of the sort. You're going to be probably riveted on the fact that, hey, that's me down there dying. That's where your attention is going to be.
That's a very valid point. I mean, certainly I have studied hundreds of cases of people who've had out-of-body and near-death experiences, and it's very variable. I mean, some of them will tell you that they were watching themselves, but also they were watching things around the room, and they were just mm-hmm. really intrigued as to what was happening. That was such an unusual phenomenon for them to be up there at the ceiling looking down that they were looking around, and some of them were only looking at themselves. And some of them will tell you that, actually, I just went straight through the ceiling. I didn't even, you know, had a glance, and then I went. So that's why, really, in order for this to work, we would have to look at, you know, over 1,000, maybe 1,500 cardiac arrest survivors, and then to try and see really what people describe and see if they can identify these hidden images and targets.
Well, doctor, with the importance of this question, I mean, I started out the program saying I think it's got to be the biggest question of all for mankind. There is no bigger question than this. Is it all over when it's over, or is there something else? So why has there not been more study. Why does it take somebody like Dr. Moody or yourself or, you know, a very few others? In other words, there's so little study of the death process itself and NDEs. Why?
I think there are lots of reasons for this, but really it comes down to a few basic issues. One simple reason is that it's actually very difficult to study people at the end of life, because if you imagine, if you take the cardiac arrest scenario, well, most of those people don't survive. Mm. And even if they do, the whole priority is really geared towards getting that person back to life, and it's very difficult to do, you know, a controlled study to find out what was happening.
Sure.
Other issues that now come up are, for example, getting a patient's consent. You know, somebody who wasn't aware of anything being wrong, suddenly they have a cardiac arrest, their heart stops. It's very difficult to get them to agree to participate. Another problem, I think, is that traditionally and historically, people have perceived the idea of studying or the whole concept of death and dying to be related more to philosophy or perhaps theology,
mm-hmm.
rather than science. And I think that has probably hindered us to some extent, because we've just assumed that it shouldn't be something that we should be dealing with. We should leave it to others to do that.
Doctor, do you think that it's a worldwide phenomenon, this understudy of death? Is it a worldwide phenomenon, or are there some countries where it's perfectly legit and they research this kind of thing?
No, it's definitely a very, very acute problem really all over the world. I mean, there are very few people, scientific papers published on this area. And that is a problem. And unfortunately, whether we like it or not, the fact is that we're all going to reach that point in our lives.
Right.
Certainly from a medical point of view, we deal with this on a daily basis. We have patients that we have to make decisions about their life and death, and we have to be able to prepare them. And also we have to know what they're going to experience. And that helps us and guides us to some extent as to how to treat them. So
all right.
This will have huge implications. It will have implications for any discussion on euthanasia in the future. And it's really one of the issues that, you know, by improving our science, we have had to take on issues that we have considered more philosophical.
All right. Here's one for you. We have only so far talked about the brain tonight, but there are several cases out there, Doctor, of organ transplants, sometimes multiple, or heart and lungs all together. I've interviewed some of these people, Doctor, and it's really bizarre. These people who are the recipient of the organs begin to get the longings and for the exact same thing that the donor loved, whether it was peanut butter sandwiches. All of a sudden they would develop this bizarre longing for peanut butter sandwiches, and it went way beyond that. And so there's some hint or some suggestion that there might be some kind of cellular memory that we don't fully understand that is not totally connected to only the brain. Have you considered that?
I've certainly heard of these descriptions as well. I don't know how to account for them, and they are very interesting. I don't really know. I don't have an answer to that. I think it really touches on to the wider issue of trying to understand where our thoughts and consciousness and everything that makes us unique as individuals comes from. And unfortunately, in science, we currently don't know, we don't have an answer for that. And it's the biggest mystery that we currently face in science. So,
oh, it sure is. And in life. So where is NDE research going? I mean, Dr. Moody had his book. Now you have written this, What Happens When We Die. Where is the research going? Is there all of a sudden going to be a lot of money available, or are we stuck in the same old place of very little research?
Unfortunately, I have to say that currently we are stuck with very little research, and that is due to the fact that there is very little funding. There are no organizations really in the world that fund research into near-death experiences. Very few charities fund research into death and dying. And so it's very difficult to get funding to do these studies. And unfortunately, as I described, the only way to get the answers is to do large-scale studies, which do cost money because we have to employ staff. What we are currently doing is trying to set up a multi-center study in the United Kingdom, we had a small grant from the UK Resuscitation Council to study this in more detail in cardiac arrest setting. But again, it's only really a startup grant. We would have to get more funding to be able to expand out into the numbers that we're looking at, which is about 30 hospitals and 1,500 cardiac arrest survivors.
All right. Here's a very, very interesting question, Doctor, and I guess it'll require a guess from you, but, you know, I talk about all kinds of fringe topics, including UFOs. UFOs is a very good example of things we talk about in this program, and I can tell you from experience, Doctor, that a very large number of people see UFOs, and a very small number of people actually report one of those things. So my question to you is, with regard to NDEs, how many do you think, because the person is probably afraid of being called a nutcase or laughed at or they're embarrassed about it or whatever the reason, what percentage do you think are not reported?
Well, I think a lot of people's experiences are not reported. Certainly the people that I have interviewed, a lot of them had told me that this was the first time they were actually talking about their experiences, but they may have had it 30, 40 years before that.
Same here. I get calls all the time.
Yes, if you think about that, I'm sure right now there are lots of people who are listening who have had an experience and they've not really been able to discuss it in detail because they're afraid of being labeled in a negative manner.
That's right.
But as I said, a Gallup survey has suggested that maybe 4 to 5% of the population have had one at some point in their life, so you can imagine that's a lot of people.
Well, and I don't know how many told Gallup no when it was really yes. So even there,
That's also a good point. Yes, absolutely.
So it could be a higher percentage, and I would bet that it's a higher percentage than we think. Just give us the very brief rundown of what one can expect with an NDE. What are the most widely reported observations of those having an NDE?
So, yes, people who come close to death for whatever reason will typically then describe feeling very peaceful, feeling joyous, seeing a bright light, sometimes seeing a tunnel and going through a tunnel towards the light. They may also describe seeing deceased relatives, perhaps a mother or a father,
mm-hmm.
and may also describe seeing a being of light, a being that they describe as being full of compassion, full of love, that sometimes accompanies this person. Sometimes they may describe having a period where they have a flashback, a review of their entire life in a moment, where they sometimes judge their own actions. They see what they had done. They may feel any pain they may have caused other people, and they may experience that at the same time.
That one scares me.
Yes. Yes, those who've had it say that. There was one lady in particular who told me that because of that experience, she's now very aware and very careful because she knows that when she dies, that's what she will experience. If she causes pain unto others, she will experience it herself.
I'm sure a lot of other people listening right now are cringing. I mean, how many of us really, honestly, folks, could face two things? One, experiencing the pain that you may have given to others in your life, and then being required to judge yourself. That's really brutal. That's really brutal. And because I know I'm no different than anybody else. I have sinned. I have, you know, treated people poorly. And so I'm not so sure that I would judge myself well, Doctor.
Well, it's very interesting. What this lady told me is that she was accompanied by this being, and she saw everything that she had done, and she could feel things that she had done to others. And it wasn't that being of light was judging her. She was then judging herself, and she was learning through it. It was really an educational process for this person. So although it was uncomfortable, but it was an educational process, and she certainly has been very much transformed positively by her experience.
Well, I can imagine that. It seems somewhat unfair, in a way, that some people have the opportunity to know that that's coming and correct their life, and most of us, on the other hand, certainly do not, except for whatever natural feelings might arise. I have interviewed over the years, Doctor, a few people who have said that they went to hell. In other words, perhaps they had judged themselves not worthy of the good side, and they actually went to hell in an NDE. It's a very sensitive, very controversial topic. How many have you talked to who have said that?
I've spoken to a few people who've said that, but I have to point something out to you about that. The majority of people who have near-death experiences have very pleasant experiences, or at least I can say that the dying process seems to be pleasant for the majority of people.
Yes.
I can't say for everybody, obviously. Where we've had accounts given by people who suggest that they've had negative near-death experiences. So they've described, for example, maybe coming across demon-like figures, maybe coming across rats,
yes,
snakes, things like that.
Yes.
The difficulty with that is, first of all, they're very rare. Secondly, we know that certainly when people are critically ill, for example, let's say when carbon dioxide levels in the blood go up,
mm-hmm,
people can start to have visions, or paranoid type of visions, where they start to see things that are coming to get them. So it's very difficult to know whether that really was what we would call a true near-death experience, or whether it's simply the person was very ill. And it goes back to the definition that I gave earlier, that we need to be able to define clearly what we mean by near death. It has to be people who are at the point of death.
Got it.
Not a very vague sort of terminology.
Yes, but doctor, if you think the normal pleasant NDE is underreported, and we both agree on that, trust me when I tell you that the hey, Mom, I had a near-death experience, and I saw the devil, and I saw people screaming, and I saw the most hellish vision in my whole life. Now you're talking about an underreported thing, doctor.
Well, the difficulty I have to just point this out again, is there have been 4 studies carried out in cardiac arrest patients. So in other words, when people have reached the point of death, and although obviously these are relatively small studies, nobody has come back in those groups and described these negative type of experiences.
Really?
It's not to say that it doesn't happen. Again, I think the problem is that we need to do large-scale studies. But simply having somebody call me and say that, you know, I had this hellish experience, it doesn't mean that it was a near-death experience. It could simply have been that they were given various drugs, or that they had been critically ill and had developed paranoid thought processes.
Mm.
It's very difficult from a scientific point of view to say. So I think what we need is a large-scale study of people during cardiac arrest and see what percentage have, you know, such negative experiences and what their features are like.
How can you imagine you might get funding, or anybody might get funding for a study exactly like that?
Well, one is obviously if there is somebody who is interested in this, who is interested in funding scientific research, and who may want to assist in this or to support this kind of work. The second way is obviously if scientific funding bodies see some benefit in this and start to divert funds.
That seems very, very unlikely. Doctor, hold it. We're at the bottom of the hour. Jonathan in London, England says, "Hey, Art, it just can't be. The whole thing doesn't make sense. Judging yourself will only adversely affect the good people. The really bad, horrible, psycho bastards who don't care and never did, never going to judge themselves guilty. They'll just have a good laugh. Then what? Into heaven?" That's an interesting point. I don't know. I guess it depends upon how much of your consciousness you carry with you into this process. And one would have to imagine that you would carry your consciousness into it, or we're not talking about anything. Words are hard, aren't they? I was going to say anything real, but it could still be real. It's an interesting question he poses, don't you think, doctor?
I think it is obviously interesting. I mean, we simply don't know enough about this, and you know, I just described a certain, you know, an anecdote or an individual person's experience. So I think we simply need more research into the dying process.
All right.
To see how we what we experience and what happens.
Let me run this one by you. I've interviewed many over the years who have had NDEs, doctor, and I once interviewed a young lady named Sarah, and I have never had a story stop me in my tracks the way this one did. She had this. She was hit by a car. She was definitely clinically dead, and she was thrown way into the air. I mean, it was a terrible accident. And she described her NDE was so specific, doctor, that she talked about actually moving to the other side down long halls full of different rooms, and she got to look into these rooms, and in some she saw people apparently suffering, in others she saw great visions. It was just so incredibly detailed and told with such conviction that you knew it was true. How many NDEs do you get of that caliber?
I have to admit I haven't ever seen or spoken to anybody who's told me that they've seen, for example, different rooms. It's difficult for me to comment on that, but certainly
I meant detail. That kind of detail. Yes.
The vast majority of people that I have interviewed have had very specific details of what they've seen, what they've experienced.
Huh.
And it's been very touching for me, very moving, really. It's really added an insight into my personal life, but also for my professional life, talking to these people.
Are you still practicing?
Oh, yes, of course, yes.
You are. Do you ever get into conversations with any of your patients on this topic? Or is it something you stay away from in your personal practice?
I would certainly talk to patients if they bring it up with me. But I have to say that usually in the acute hospital setting, patients who've had near-death experiences won't bring it up unless they're specifically asked and if they trust the person who's asking them, because they're usually afraid of being labeled in a negative manner.
Yeah.
And also, sometimes it's a little bit, in the initial stages, it can be a little bit traumatic for them because it gives them a realization that they really had been close to dying and that maybe they wouldn't be here today or at that time to talk about it.
Sure.
Sometimes they feel that they need a bit of time to really, it's not so much the experience, it's the knowledge that really, maybe today I wouldn't be here. I almost died.
To process the information, that alone would be hard.
Yes.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. I wonder if since Dr. Moody's book, when patients or the relatives of patients hear that, you know, their relative or whatever did indeed clinically die for a period of time, we probably live in a day and age where that question would much more likely be asked, right? Since the book?
I think generally speaking in the last 25, 30 years, there has been a trend towards more acceptance of this, and I think certainly yes, there have been changes. When they were first described, people were much more negative about them.
So relatives are more likely. Are relatives another kind of interesting question? Are you bound, doctor, to tell the relatives or friends of a person who has clinically died, or even that person themselves, that they did clinically die?
Well, we tell patients, it very much depends on the particular circumstances. We would normally tell their relatives that they had had a cardiac arrest and that they'd been very critically ill. Obviously, say, for example, if I'm involved in a cardiac arrest resuscitation and an immediate family member arrives and they're very concerned, then we would communicate with them quite often during the whole process. We would tell them that what's happened to their loved one, that they have essentially had a cardiac arrest and that we're trying to restart their heart.
Oh, okay.
And then we will go back and tell them whether we've been successful, whether we're still trying, and unfortunately, whether we hadn't been successful.
That must be very difficult.
It's very difficult. Usually the relatives are more in a state of shock, I have to say.
Yes.
Is very difficult. Obviously, yeah. It's not good news.
Yeah, I know about shock. Okay. Have you personally concluded, doctor, that NDEs are real?
I think that near-death experiences certainly take place and certainly give us an indication of what we're likely to experience at the end of our lives. And for the majority of people, they are pleasant. What I can't tell is whether they indicate something of an external reality, whether there is an afterlife or not. But certainly if you look at the anecdotal cases, as I said, the area that we can test and we can try and validate are people who claim to have had out-of-body experiences, because they come back and tell us in specific detail what we had done and what was happening, and those can be verified. And certainly we now have the scientific means and the technology to be able to test these theories and to find out what happens to the human mind and consciousness at the end of life, and how it relates to the brain.
I want to talk about consciousness. Doctor, there have been, I think, claims that some scientists or doctors have made that they were able to electrically stimulate some part of the brain and cause an NDE. Is there anything to that?
There is some element of accuracy with this. There was a paper published in 2002, a scientific paper published by a group of Swiss doctors. And what they were doing is they had a patient who had been suffering with intractable epilepsy. Mm-hmm. And as part of this treatment, they tried to identify, this is done all over the world, but this happened to this group of doctors in Switzerland, where doctors will try to stimulate different parts of the brain electrically.
Yes.
To try to identify the area of the brain that has an abnormal electrical rhythm that's causing the epilepsy and the seizures. And what they found as part of their routine workup for a particular patient is that by stimulating a specific area of the brain, the patient started to describe what sounded very much like an out-of-body experience.
Well, yes.
It wasn't a complete one, but she felt that she was able to see at least half of her body. It's very difficult to comment beyond that because this is a single case report, and there have been other cases like this before where doctors had stimulated similar experiences. What this tells us is that certainly there are areas of the brain that mediate the experiences. So, for example, if you imagine if I were to go out into the street and for example, a car hits me, or I have a heart attack, or I have very severe meningitis, something that then causes me to come close to death and then eventually die, mm-hmm. the changes, the physiological or biological changes that take place in my body will stimulate certain parts of the brain, and they will lead to an experience. However, what that doesn't tell us is whether the experience is real or not. It just
right.
simply tells us that specific parts of the brain are involved with it. Now, if we then go back and artificially stimulate those same parts of the brain, we can induce the same experience.
Okay. So then if we're looking for proof about whether an experience is real or not, the people who rise to the top of the room and are able to see everything going on when they have absolutely nothing going on in their brain at all, when they're flatlined, those people might be the best evidence that this is a real experience. Would you agree?
So those are the only people that can be studied and objectively through scientific means currently, absolutely. I just want to just, if I may, just finish off my last point. Just
yes, of course.
Because this is important, because a lot of people think that, oh, simply because we identify or we can stimulate parts of the brain and cause an experience, that means that it must be a hallucination or mm-hmm. it must be unreal.
Right.
And that's absolutely incorrect. The reason for that is because if you think about it, if we take again a mother, when a mother sees, say, a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old child, that seeing of the child will induce feelings of love and compassion and all maternal feelings towards. And we can study the brain accurately and find out which parts of the brain mediate that love. What we can then do is artificially stimulate the same parts of the brain and lead to the same sensation of love.
Ah.
Okay?
Uh-huh. Oh, but isn't that something? The love part of the brain.
Any part, any sensation that we have, any experience that we have.
We can identify where it is, stimulate it, and sort of reproduce it artificially. Wow.
So in the same way that you wouldn't say maternal love is a hallucination, in exactly the same way we cannot say, simply because we know which parts of the brain may be involved, that this experience is unreal. The way I also think about it for myself is if you think about when the body is going through the dying process, it's a bit like a jet pilot, a fighter jet pilot, who has had a malfunction with his plane, and it's about to crash. And he or she will try the best they can to try to keep the plane in the air, but eventually they get to a point where they realize, actually, No matter what they do, the plane is going to crash, and all they can do is bail themselves out. So they'll press a little button, and then they'll eject out of the plane. And it may be that when we're dying, that there are various keys that are being pressed in the brain to try and keep it alive, and eventually the brain says, well, it's not going to work, we're going to die. Then the person has this experience, and they may then have this separation of their consciousness or their mind from the brain at that time, which is what we then see as an out-of-body experience.
Okay, but it has to be real. I mean, it has to be real. If somebody can come back and describe what went on and what was said when they were dead, then it has to be real.
Yes, what that would mean, and by real I'll just define that, what that would mean is that, and this is very difficult for us to understand and explain scientifically, but we'd have to accept it and we'd have to try to understand it better, is that actually there can be a separation of mind and consciousness from the brain.
Right.
At the end of life or at any other time, that actually mind and consciousness may not only be simply be a product of brain activity, it may be a separate scientific entity that we haven't yet discovered.
I've got a fast blast here. That's a little computer. People can talk to me by computer while the show's going on, and they're reminding me that there was a very old study that I'd love to have you comment on. I wish I had the, I think it was, might have been Reuters News or AP Now. One of the big wire services reported on this doctor who in the 1800s, Dr. Parnia, actually measured people's weight at the moment of death.
Yes.
Are you familiar with the study?
I've heard of it, yes.
In the study, people lost varying but significant amounts of weight at the instant of death. And people have said all kinds of things about it, but this was done back in the days when such a study, ethically, I guess, could be done. And for all the research I could do, it seemed absolutely legitimate. And I doubt in the modern day that we've done such a thing, but, you know, the contention was that this was the soul, that the soul had some physical weight or something, and was continually measured as, you know, an ounce or two or three or whatever at the instant of death. Any comments on that?
Well, I've been told about this as well. I think my reaction to it is that it's very difficult to draw such a conclusion. I mean, if you think about it, there are so many limitations with this kind of work or concept, because the first limitation is the apparatus that's being used accurate enough to measure that sort of change?
Right.
The second problem is, obviously, when someone is dying, there will be shifts in their bodily fluid amounts. And if we're only talking a few grams, then it's very difficult to say that this wasn't due to a simple shift in some sort of bodily fluid.
Now, the study showed ounces.
Or ounces. That what I'm saying is, it's very difficult to comment that this is not something physical that's happening in the body.
Uh-huh.
And then to be able to attribute it to something else. So I simply don't know. I mean, I've heard about it, but that's all I can really say.
Then there's one other thing. I have interviewed many people over the years doing a program like this who have been with a dying person at the actual instant of death. And many times, you know, relatives will, of course, put their arms around the person or lean over them in some way. And I've had these accounts, Doctor, of people who said they actually felt something move through them at the instant of that person's death. In other words, they were above them and they actually felt something move through them. Have you heard any of those accounts?
I've heard of some people say things like that when they've been with their relatives.
Yes.
I really can't comment beyond the fact of just saying that I've heard about it. I don't know if they're true or not. I mean, obviously they're true to the person, but I don't know what they signify.
All right. Money for the kind of work that you're doing, money for research, it doesn't seem very likely to me it's going to come from our government, although you never know. I just wonder, if you were to try to make the case, Doctor, for getting a research grant for this, and you had to come up with some medical benefit, some benefit to the medical community in order to justify the study, could you do it?
Absolutely. This area is very new, it's novel, and it has huge implications for us all. It has both medical implications and social implications. The benefits from a medical point of view is that, one, we need to understand what our patients go through at the end of life, and particularly during cardiac arrest. We've now had four scientific studies that have suggested that our mind or consciousness of our patients during cardiac arrest, at least in 10 to 20%, may continue to function, even though there is a lack of brain activity, as far as we can see and as far as studies have indicated. And this needs to be verified. It needs to be done in a larger scale. And if it's true, it would probably help us in trying to understand the biggest mystery in science, which is actually what is the nature of human consciousness, thought, and how it relates to the brain. Another very interesting area where this would benefit society and medical practice in particular is that, and we haven't touched on this very much tonight, is that people who have near-death experiences, particularly those who see a being of light, when they come back, they're positively transformed by this experience.
Yes.
They become more altruistic, they become less materialistic, they become much more engaged with their family, society in general, they become much more empathetic. And this has also been demonstrated in a study carried out in Holland, and that was published a few years ago in cardiac arrest patients. And it's essentially a very positive experience for the people, and it stays with them for many years, perhaps decades, until they die. And again, as I pointed out earlier, everything that we experience, we know is mediated through certain changes within the body or the brain. And what we'd like to do ultimately is to identify what are the molecular changes.